And welcome to our parallel session today on humanity, sciences, and personhood in our conference on being human and human flourishing. I do have to wonder if the surfers out there are doing well at human, doing better at human flourishing than we are right now. But so, as always, we have a packed morning and lots of interesting, fascinating speakers. And time is tight, as always. So our first speaker, but I'm excited about this session, my interest, the integration of biology, psychology, theology. So our first speaker is Roman Miller from Eastern Mennonite University, and he's speaking on the emergence of our personhood. Please welcome him.
Thank you. It's good to be with you. By way of brief introduction, I retired from Eastern Mennonite University a few years ago after teaching for 30-some years in biology, biomedicine, and so this kind of emerges from that. I'm going to talk about a bit of ontogeny and theology with a bias. My bias is an Anabaptist, and I'll try to explain what all that is. Help us work through this. Here's an outline of what I'm going to cover in the next 19 minutes. Going to talk, after a brief introduction, what is real. Then we're going to look a little bit at philosophy on this topic and distinguish between substance and property. Then I'll give a couple ontogeny examples. Then we move, and I'll try to describe what I mean by Anabaptist eyes. And then I'll use a few examples from biblical theology, and then in the conclusion, we'll talk a bit about emergent personhood, and then I'll have a brief epilogue. So that's where we're going. In most of the slides, you'll see in the upper left corner where I am on the outline, so you know where we're going. Okay, here we go. Foundational questions that we need to think about. And the first one is probably the one I'm going to spend the most time with. What is the essence of our being? What is the core of what makes you what you are? And then the related question, can ontogeny, which I'm going to talk about and define in a moment, and theology give us insights? Is the essence synonymous with biological life? Is it synonymous with personhood? Some people would say it is. I disagree. Are the unborn one of us? If so, how? Why? If not, why not? When and how did we emerge as persons and gain that personhood? We would all say today we have personhood. A couple definitions. Ontogeny. When I use that word, I'm describing the origination and development of an organism, both the physical aspects of the organism as well as the psychological ones. From the time of fertilization of an ovum by a sperm through adulthood, it's more than embryology and embryonic development, okay? That's included. That's a subset of ontogeny. The second definition that I want to talk about is personhood. I've read too many articles about personhood. People define it in many, many different ways. And rather than spending time in talking about all of those, I like the definition for the most part that White gives, and I'll just simply read it for you from the screen. He suggests that a Christian view sees personhood as a distinctly human state within the natural order. It's something that's intrinsic to human life, and by that, it's not the same as human life, it's intrinsic to it. Note the word. It's independent of the status of the human being. This existential construct holds that personhood is not a creation of the society. It's not a right. It cannot be altered or removed by human fiat. What is real? That's really the first question. And I think for all of us in this world and in this room, we would say we know that the material world, the physical world, is real. If you are a materialist, you would say that's what it is. And Anything that's outside of that circle isn't real. From a Christian perspective, we would also say that while it is very true that this cosmos is real, there is a reality that is just as real as the physical objects that we encounter every day. That's a metaphysical part, a spiritual world. And furthermore, we suggest that there is interaction between those two realities. It's not that one is real and the other one is not real, but they're both real. What makes them real is really the question. And the answer to that is they're both created by God. God created, we believe, a material world. God also created a spiritual world, and furthermore, continually interacts with both of those worlds. If you're a deist, you would agree that God created those, and then he went off and had a cup of coffee somewhere, and he hasn't been back since. But Christians would say, no, he's here. He's among us. He touches us. He does stuff. And we respond to him. Let's look at philosophy for a moment. My philosophical argument, especially as we look at this topic, is looking at an early human embryo. And my argument is that an early human embryo is a substance thing, not a property thing. So what do I mean by that? Well, I suggest there are at least two kinds of entities. There are substance things and there are property things. What's a substance thing? If you look at the little diagram, the child is a substance thing. It has, she has, an internal essence with a holistic ordering capacity that defines and orders several things, changes, transformations, and functions according to particular principles that one can see. Now, there is also in that diagram a property thing. That's the scooter. It's a collection or an ordered aggregate of various parts, and the order that comes is externally imposed. What's true? True about many of the property things, of course, is that once they are put together, there is an emergent function that comes out of those. If one of the pieces fails, then the function is lost. Okay, that's typical that we have in a property thing. Well, let's go to the human embryo because that's really where the argument is going. If you look at the diagram, what we have here is a very early human embryo there on the bottom right. And let me get my laser pointer going here. So there you see the human embryo. It's probably a marula about day 2.5 or 3 post-fertilization. And my suggestion is that that is a substance thing. But it's also because it has an internal ordering essence. But it can become a property thing. How? Well, it's possible to take this embryo with its multiplicity of totipotent cells, disperse them, and put them in dishes with regular, with different kinds of factors, and create out of that muscle cells, liver cells, different pancreatic cells, etc. Those become property. But what happens at the same time, this embryo has lost its internal organizing essence. It's lost and it can't be regained. I can't put the cells back together and get the embryo again. We haven't been able to do that. In a similar way, personhood can be abused. And I'll give you a couple of examples of that, abusing personhood. This is one we're all familiar with, that historically in this country, we have abused, enslaved, selected persons because they were considered inferior. And that was justified because they weren't like everybody else. Nazi Germany would be another good example where they debased Jewish and Polish persons. But I would also say today, therapeutic cloning using embryos, dissociating them, is also abusing persons in a similar way. But we justify it. We justify for two reasons. One is we say these embryos really aren't persons. They might be potential persons, but they ain't persons yet. Okay, that's often what we say. The second thing is we look at a consequence. We think of all the good that can come from it. Look how many adult humans can be helped if you destroy this embryo. Okay, that's the justification. I think that's still abuse, and so you see a bias that I have, and I think we should use foresight. Let's go to ontogeny now. An ontogeny argument would be that an early human embryo is biological, but it is plus more. And what I want you to do is to listen for the plus more portion. So your earliest history, probably as an individual, was beginning here as a zygote. Here is a zygote, a picture of one. And that essence that I'm describing is present in that zygote and has continued to today, to you, and will continue, God willing, in the future. This zygote that we have here in the picture represents a continuation of life. I have friends, for an example, who say, well, Roman, when does life begin? When did your life begin? And I say that's the wrong question, because my biological life did not begin, neither did yours. My biological life was a continuation of a living sperm, of a living ovum that merged, and that life continued. Okay, there was another question that one should ask, but that's the zygote is a continuation of life. The zygote has, of course, genetic components that order it in many ways, but it also has this internal ordering essence that allows it to do many different things, as we will subsequently see. I'm going to give two examples from ontogeny. And the first one basically deals with the fact that differentiation in early embryonic development produces self-identity. And so I got to do a little bit of biology. Look at the diagram. This is a diagram of a human woman uterus. This is the fallopian tube or the uterine tube. And here would represent, right here would be an ovum that's being fertilized. And then as time progresses, this moves down the fallopian tube, down into the uterus and then implants. So that's what you're seeing on the diagram, okay? So the first point I want to make is that way over here, this marula here, the cells there are totipotent. You could dissociate those cells and you could create more than one embryo out of them. But once differentiation occurs, then that is lost. So if you look at the next slide, the circle that I just put there, you'll see that this structure and this structure is now a bit different, because they've undergone a certain amount of differentiation. We call it compaction, and there's a cavity here that forms. And so now we have, if you look at this structure right here, on the next slide you're going to see another picture of it, which looks like this. It now has a couple different kinds of cells. It has this inner cell mass that's going to be the body of the embryo. You looked like this one time. And then you have these outer cells that are going to form structures like the placenta, et cetera, et cetera. That's what differentiation does. So differentiation means these cells are no longer totipotent, but now you have an entity here that is self-identified. It's surrounded by this blue thing here that we would call a zona pellucida that separates it from everything else, and it's going to move down the fallopian tube and implant itself in the maternal wall. And I'm going to talk about that implantation really quickly. There are several steps to it. Here we have a picture or a diagram of the same. Here, this is the wall of the uterus. Here is the embryo implanting itself into that wall. And as time progresses, a lot of things happen. I will say one thing about the connection. The embryo creates molecules on its surface that attaches to molecules or structures from the human or from the mother. And that's what helps bind it here. We call these binding ligands. But then with time, this embryo moves into the wall, day 7 and 8, a little bit further, day, and I won't go through all the details of this, day 9 and 10, you see it's almost buried inside of the wall, until we get to this stage, which is about day 11 or 12, and I want to make a couple points. Here the embryo is produced these little finger-like projections, which are going to become villi, which make it attach. But then what becomes interesting is something else. This embryo begins to secrete a unique hormone called human chorionic gonadotropin. It's the first time the mother has experienced it. So if the mother who has this implanted embryo all of a sudden realizes she's missed her period and she wonders, am I pregnant? So she runs to the, what do you call it? I was going to say the hardware store, but she doesn't go to the hardware store. She runs to the pharmacy and gets a pregnancy test, right? And when she looks at it, if it turns pink, ooh, I'm pregnant. What did the pregnancy test measure? The pregnancy test measured this hormone produced by the embryo, not by the mother, human chorionic gonadotropin. What's the purpose of that hormone? The purpose of that hormone is to stimulate the mother to produce progesterone. And my time is just flipping away. So I want to make this point, then I'm going to skip some other stuff and try to get to the end. I've used these ontogeny examples to raise this point that Torres did, and I'll just read his comment. The point which I wish to raise is that there is and must be a regulatory force and indeed a controlling source of information beyond the anatomical and organic structure of the embryo, something over and above its genetic constituents, which is genetically inexplicable and indescribable, to which its formation, genetic structure, and information content are indebted, and which bears upon the human nature and life of the developing embryo from the moment of conception. So he's talking about an internal essence. I'm going to skip the Anabaptist I thing, simply because I don't have time, and let me go to the next thing. Couple of examples from the Bible. What is this internal ordering essence? Well, let's look at Jesus, because that's what Anabaptists try to do, the centrality of Jesus. So with this very familiar story, the angel comes to Mary and says, you're going to be pregnant, you're going to have a child, how can it be? And look at the verse, the Holy Spirit will come upon you, the power of the Most High will overshadow you. So there's spirit going on here in this case. Later, we see again in the account in Luke, Jesus grows, his personhood emerges, he grows in wisdom and in stature, he learns obedience. And then let's look at his death. On the cross, when Jesus is dying, the one thief says, Lord, remember me when you come into the kingdom, and Jesus says, today you're going to be with me in paradise. And so the real question is, what was the essence of these two people that are going to be together in paradise? That's a fundamental question. But look at Jesus' death. When Jesus died, he cries out with a loud voice, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. And when he said this, he breathed his last. You find the same thing in the other gospel accounts. Jesus giving up his spirit, that's the essence, I would argue, of his being. And the biblical use of spirit describes it often as a vital principle by which the body is emanated, a simple essence that possesses power, it infiltrates and governs the soul. And there are many Bible examples of using spirit or pneuma, which is the Greek word, 300 and some times in the New Testament. And I don't have time to do all of those, and so I'm going to skip through them, but that you find those over and over and over again, talking about spirit influencing body, spirit being what God has given us and what God desires from us. Conclusion. I argue that the essence of our being is the foundation of our personhood. And that essence is spirit. Spirit is what makes me and you what we are. When we die, it is our spirit, in analogous to Jesus, that lives and continues beyond. Spirit directs our body. It's also influenced. It's not biological life. Rather, it empowers biological life. Personhood is a normal emergent quality of our being and comes both after, prior to, and after birth. And as persons motivated by spirits, we can choose between love and hate and wounding or healing and be generous or selfish, etc. It's our spirits that are involved in that. I was heartened by reading this paper by Von de Waal when he says, "I'm an embryologist in search for spirit. Where do I look for spirit in the body?" And I have him as one of my references, and you can look at it, but he does a good job of talking about that. Let me just, I'm going to skip this part, and let me just conclude with this. So here's a bibliography of some of the major things that I've read. There are many other things, and I think my time is totally done. And so if there's time for any questions or comments, I'll take whatever's there.
Yeah, you did well with your 20 minutes. And for everyone who came late, we are running 5 minutes behind. And a reminder, we don't have a microphone, so everyone needs to speak up. I'm going to ask you just to give 1 minute of those 10 or so slides you skipped over in terms of, can you describe the distinctives of Anabaptist theology that inform your thinking?
Two things that I did there. One is the centrality of Jesus. So when we want to look at what it means to be a person, let's look at Jesus. Often we start in Genesis 1 and 2. There's nothing wrong with that. But from an Anabaptist perspective, we can look at Jesus and see what made Jesus of Nazareth a human person. So that's why we started there. The second thing is grace. Anabaptist understanding of grace is a bit different. Grace has substance in our understanding. It's God's divine enablement. Grace is God's power, God's spirit, moving into our spirit. It's a spirit-to-spirit thing. Jesus told the woman at the well, God is a spirit. Those who worship him must worship him. How? In spirit and in truth. And so a strong emphasis, that's what grace is. It's not simply God's unmerited favor that God feels good about us, but it's something about God's power that changes us. That's a long answer to your short
question.
That's
okay. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Field questions.
Go ahead. I'll take it.
Thanks for your talk. Was there a point, like, are you saying that there are certain parts of embryonic development that can only be explained by appealing to the kind of the causal role of an immaterial spirit or a soul to kind of explain what's going on?
That's what I'm saying. And I didn't develop as well as I could have. Because, let me just back up. If you're a total...
Let's say my worry is just that it seems like a bit of a... It might be potentially susceptible to like a God of the gaps kind of...
I understand that.
So that if you can give a biological explanation for that, then maybe it kind of...
Yes, I agree.
Okay.
I don't think it's that, but probably... There was a question over here. Yes, come in.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your view and also what you presented. I noted, I was curious if you would define zygote again, because your photo, I think, shows two nuclei before fusion. Am I correct?
Yeah, the one nucleus would have been the maternal one, and the other would have been the sperm. So those are really pronuclei. And so that's it's not a zygote dividing. It's so, prior to division.
Okay, so it's the zygote you are defining as having united.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm just curious, you mentioned about, I think if I caught what you said correctly, that the spirit is the essence of the person. And I was wondering how the body fits in with that. What does the body contribute to our personhood? And I'm specifically thinking of what Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians 15, where he talks about that there needs to be a resurrection where our spirits need to be rejoined with bodies in the new heavens and new earth for us to be really, it seems like really human.
I guess I would answer by saying that our spirits express themselves through our bodies. But there is enough in the New Testament, if you simply look at pneuma, which is the Greek word for spirit, to recognize that they aren't the same thing. They're different. So I would be a dualist in that fashion. Anyone else? Yes.
How would you, can you relate this to the image of God that we're not always, that in Genesis, God breathed into Adam, communicating spirit, and breathed the God's spirit into, and Adam became like a person or something, which is maybe different than biological, but there's something about that that might relate to what you're talking about.
Well, I guess my response is that God's infused spirit into us in analogous, which is what happened in the case of Adam. When I die, my biological life is lost, but my spirit continues. And my spirit, the hope of the Christian, is that my body or a body will be resurrected that my spirit can indwell. If I understand that right, there's a question back there, yeah.
So I know,
and maybe I've taken too much time.
No, we're okay.
I know you're a biologist, so am I. And I think you're standing up for the rights of the abortion. I like that. I'm just interested, maybe the exact step when that spirit is infused. So is it when the actual fusion of sperm and egg happen, or is it when the nuclei, pronuclei fuse, or what do you think about that?
If you answer that question, then we'll both know. No, I don't know. The similar fashion, it's like asking me, can you explain how it is that the power of the Holy Spirit made Mary pregnant? I have no idea. All I know that that's the way it worked. Okay, so I leave that in God's hands. And I think I would say the same thing. But my strong push on the spirit as being the essence of ourselves is that it seemed to be that way, especially if I look at the New Testament all the time.
Along those same lines, I was wondering, you were talking about continuation of life. So would you say there's continuation of spirit?
No.
Okay. You want to be strict.
I don't think. No, because I think spirit is a gift of God. One of the verses that he didn't talk about is the fact that Hebrews uses the example that God, being a giver of spirit, earnestly desires our spirits. And so I think that's unique. Thank you.